The UK premiere of Richard Dubignon's Battlefield Concerto, performed by the duo for whom it was written, Katia and Marielle Labeck, who are now applauding the composer, Richard Dubignon, as he makes his way on stage here. He was born in Lausanne, and he has dual nationality, in fact, Swiss and French. He studied in Montpellier and chose to follow parallel careers as a composer and a double bass player. And actually, he had a spell of studying here in London, too. He graduated from the Royal Academy of Music. And Semyon Bychkov lining up with the two soloists and Richard Dubignon. The composer said he couldn't resist the chance to write this piece for Katia and Marielle Labeck. He was interested, he said, in reflecting their different personalities, as well as exploring whole new ways of writing for two pianos and orchestra. He noticed that normally the two pianos tend to play together, and he thought he'd have a go at seeing what would happen if they didn't do that, and instead were represented as contrasting elements. It's just the latest in a line of new works by distinguished contemporary composers written for Katia and Marielle Labeck. They're great advocates and supporters of contemporary music. They were recently the subject of a documentary by the Spanish film director Pedro Almodovar. And they've been working recently on a new project in New York, the Minimalist Dream House, which involves artists and musicians from both classical and rock music fields. And they're back on stage now. Two very vivid personalities reflected in their concert outfits. Deep purple for Marielle and a neon green jacket for Katia. And applause now for the members of the BBC Symphony Orchestra. The two offstage but visible trumpets were Gareth Bimson and playing bass trumpet Duncan Wilson. And joining the BBC Symphony Orchestra, unusually, a bass guitarist, James Woodrow. Semyon Bychkov bringing up the rear as soloists and composer make their way off stage. It's a bit of a family setup tonight. Semyon Bychkov is married to Marielle Labeck, and the two sisters coming back on stage now. Thank you. a bluesy, jazzy encore from Katia and Marielle Labeck. And it's nice to see that Semyon Bychkov and Richard Dubignon didn't go off stage, but perched themselves at the back by the tents and just grooved away to that. Jet Song from Leonard Bernstein's West Side Story, which Katia and Marielle Labeck have recently been recording. Rather nicely continuing the theme of battle, of course, between the Sharks and the Jets in Bernstein's show. And back they come. Their career really began with the recording of George Gershwin. And it's been onwards and upwards ever since. A best-selling record, that one. And he's still a favourite composer of theirs, although they've also pursued separate careers, Katia in particular. Records on their own label and pursues projects of her own. But of course, they get together, as they did tonight so very memorably here at the BBC Proms. Well, we've reached the interval in our prom tonight. In 25 minutes or so, we're going to hear the BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Semyon Bychkov, in just one work, Richard Strauss's tone poem, Ein Heldenleben, A Hero's Life. Meanwhile, it's time to join Rana Mitter and his guests for tonight's Proms Plus literary event, recorded earlier this evening at the Royal College of Music, across the road from us here at the Royal Albert Hall.
Good evening. I'm delighted to be joined by one of the rising stars of the musical firmament, the conductor Edward Gardner. Appointed as music director of the English National Opera before he was 40, he's been associated with a range of innovative productions, and he's also something of a constant gardener at this year's proms. He'll be back conducting Britain's Peter Grimes on the 24th of August. But tonight, he'll be talking about what happens when he lays the baton down and what he reads in his spare time. I mean, Edward, you have a pretty constant conducting schedule. How do you choose what to read in that precious spare time that you actually have?
I'm terrible about taking scores to bed and reading them up close to bedtime. So when I'm working, I tend to be reading either around the pieces I'm doing or reading the scores themselves. So when I get a chance, when I get a holiday, I read as much as I possibly can. I'll take tens of books on holiday with me and just get through them feverishly.
And when you do that, are you making a sort of rational choice? I have a certain number of pieces of fiction, certain number of non-fiction, or is it just what you can find on the shelf to shove in the suitcase?
Well, I go for a lot of late 20th century, early 21st century fiction. Something historical things about London and about England I'm fascinated by, and it's mostly because I gave up history when I was 13, and I have a terrible knowledge of our history and the history of this city, and I find it really intoxicating to read about it now. Also historical novels, which is very dangerous if you don't have any history because you think everything you're reading is true. And the odd, Busman's Holiday book for sure, but very limited. It's more about newish fiction actually when I read.
Well, you've given an indication of some of the pleasures that are coming up, and it's also a great pleasure that we have the actor John Rowe with us tonight, who's going to read some extracts from some of the books that you've chosen. And we're going to hear the first one, which comes from last year's Booker Prize winner, The Sense of an Ending by Julian Barnes. John.
My bookshelves were more successful with Veronica than my record collection. In those days, paperbacks came in their traditional liveries, orange penguins for fiction, blue pelicans for non-fiction. To have more blue than orange on your shelf was proof of seriousness. And overall, I had enough of the right titles. Richard Hoggart, Stephen Runciman, Hautzinger, Isink, Empson, plus Bishop John Robinson's Honest to God next to my Larry cartoon books. Veronica paid me the compliment of assuming I'd read them all and didn't suspect that the most worn titles had been bought second-hand. Her own shelves held a lot of poetry in volume and pamphlet form. Eliot, Auden, McNeice, D.V. Smith, Tom Gunn, Ted Hughes. There were Left Book Club editions of Orwell and Koestler, some calf-bound 19th-century novels, a couple of childhood Arthur Rackhams, and her comfort book, I Capture the Castle. I didn't for a moment doubt that she had read them all, or that they were the right books to own. Further, they seemed to be an organic continuation of her mind and personality, whereas mine struck me as functionally separate, straining to describe a character I hoped to grow into. This disparity threw me into a slight panic, and as I looked along her poetry shelf, I fell back on a line from my old teacher, Phil Dixon. Of course, everyone's wondering what Ted Hughes will do when he runs out of animals. Are they? Well, so I've been told, I said feebly. In Dixon's mouth, the line had seemed witty and sophisticated. In mine, merely facetious.
Well, John Rowe there conjuring up the spirit of the protagonist Tony Webster from The Sense of an Ending by Julian Barnes. And I had to say, I was cringing in recognition during that particular passage, Edward, because, well, in my case, I think I seem to remember moving a copy of The Vivid Orange Spine of a copy of I, Claudius onto my shelf. I'm not sure quite who that was supposed to impress. I mean, was that one of the reasons the passage appealed to you, that it basically was a familiar experience that you had?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, yeah, it certainly, I blushed and sweated slightly as I read it with recognising the pretensions of a young university student. It very much so. It's so beautifully written in that sardonic way. It's a kind of essay in the passing of time as much as anything else and repercussions of consequences of your life. I marvelled at it as much as identified with it and the way your perceptions of your past and what you've done and what you've experienced change with your emotional state. I mean, there's this wonderful theme that runs through the book of him, the protagonist, going to see the Seven Boar. And his memory of it changes acutely, actually, both emotionally and in terms of who was there with him through this book. And it's magically put together.
You also said that nonfiction is, and history is, one of your loves, and we should in a moment hear an extract from one of your nonfiction choices, which is Nigel Jones's book, The Tower, which he describes as an epic history of the Tower of London. And we're going to start with a passage which describes a new arrival at the zoo established in the Tower by King Henry III back in the 13th century. John.
In 1252, the creatures at the Tower were joined by another exotic animal, a polar bear sent to Henry by King Haakon IV of Norway arrived, along with a Norwegian keeper. The first ever seen in England, the polar bear attracted enormous public curiosity. When the 2 pence a day allowance provided by the sheriffs of London for its upkeep proved insufficient to meet the beast's appetite, the bear was allowed to fish for free food in the river running past its tower enclosure. With his usual attention to detail, Henry spelt it out. Greetings. We command you that for the keeper of our white bear, lately arrived from Norway, ye cause to be had one muzzle and one iron chain to hold the bear without the water, and one long strong cord to hold the same bear fishing or washing himself in the River Thames. 3 years later, in 1255, when Londoners had got used to the strange sight of the bear swiping salmon out of the Thames, an even more wondrous beast lumbered into view. Befitting its size and status, the entry of this new addition to the Tower menagerie was slow and stately, attracting enormous crowds en route, like the progress of a superstar, which it was. The first elephant to appear in these islands plodded up the pilgrim's way from Canterbury to London, led by its keeper, Henricus de Flor. Yet another gift to Henry from a fellow European monarch, Louis IX of France, the elephant made a spectacular entrance to the Tower via a large riverboat. Such was the jumbo's celebrity that the aged contemporary chronicler, the monk Matthew Paris, was lured from his abbey in St. Albans to the Tower to see the new arrival. Drawing the elephant in a memorable picture, as well as in words, the beast is about 10 years old, possessing a rough hide rather than fur, has small eyes at the top of his head, and eats and drinks with a trunk.
Many thanks, John. I mean, that's an extraordinary thought, a polar bear fishing on the banks of the Thames. I think wasn't even thought of as part of the Cultural Olympiad. This was clearly going one stage beyond that. Did you know anything about this wonderful detail of a private zoo at the Tower of London before reading this book?
I did know something about it, but the book it goes into incredible detail about it. And I love, one of the things I like about this book is the pageant of it, that you really get this, it's a very brutal book in many ways and focuses on lots of, warring skirmishes amongst other things, and changes of monarchy.
I mean, is it that wider historical pageant and, you know, this sort of mixture of pageantry and violence that fascinates you in terms of the wider story?
I feel a big vacuum in my knowledge about history, and it's something which I'm more aware of the more I do. And, you know, my work is based in history. It's based in, you know, the context of great musical works of art over the last 400-500 years. And I'm mildly ashamed that, well, I put it stronger than that, I'm pretty ashamed that I don't have a stronger knowledge of the story around that. I went recently to Australia and I took Simon Sharma's History of Britain as an audiobook and listened to that every night with jet lag, actually. And I saw Timothy West, who's narrating it, actually came to a performance at ENO soon after I got back, and I told him that he helped put me to sleep every night, which wasn't necessarily such a big compliment for a great actor. But it's just something I'd really want to develop in myself.
When you're actually preparing an operatic production, do you find that there's a need to actually read up on the history of the story or the circumstances in which the production came together? And I'm thinking you're conducting Peter Grimes later at the Proms, and of course George Crabbe's poem, The Borough, very much at the background of that, adapted, of course, in the 20th century for Grimes. How important is that background reading for you on that sort of production?
Yes, it's very important, actually, and Billy Budd recently as well, that we've done at ENO. I do, more and more I do, actually. And I've been fortunate recently to do a lot of music where the composers were at least around their recordings. In Britain's case, he was conducting, you know, many of the recordings. And the flavour of that time is so important to capture, and it's hard to do in the modern world, I think. I'm thinking of pieces like Rosenkavalier, which I've conducted this year. I think you need to know the flavour of what was going on, and it was immensely helpful for me to listen to Eric Kleiber's recordings from the 50s in Vienna to get a sense of that. I mean, it's a perfume, isn't it, that you can't just pluck out of the air in today's world.
Well, let's stick with the Tower of London for a couple of minutes more, because in many people's minds, it is regarded as a place of torture and of terror. And of course, as you've suggested, that is in Nigel Jones's book. But it was also something of a refuge for at least some people. And the second extract you've chosen suggests that rather strongly. John.
King Henry VI vanished for more than a year, leaving behind only a few pathetic belongings, including his crown and a spoon. He was sheltered by loyal northern gentry, shuttling between their homes and sometimes, appropriately for such a pious man, disguised as a monk seeking sanctuary at religious houses. In July 1465, the fugitive king was hiding at Waddington Hall near Clitheroe in Lancashire, the home of the Tempest family, under the care of his former carver and chamberlain, Sir Richard Tunstall. But one member of the family, John Tempest, did not share his relative's Lancastrian loyalty. Informed by a treacherous monk of the mystery guest at the hall, Tempest organized a posse. When they arrived, a furious struggle ensued. Tunstall held the pursuers off, breaking Tempest's arm in the process, while Henry, accompanied only by two chaplains and a single squire, made off into nearby Clither Wood. Later that afternoon, Henry and his companions were caught, crossing the River Ribble by stepping stones, and arrested. Humiliatingly, Henry, wearing a straw hat in the summer heat, was mounted on a poor thin nag. His feet were bound under the stirrups by leather thongs, and lashed to his saddle with rope, he was brought to London. He was received at Islington by the Earl of Warwick and led through the city's streets towards the Tower, a placard scrawled with insults around his neck. It was a tragic and frightening return to his capital for the mentally frail, fallen monarch. As the forlorn little procession rode through Cheapside, Cornhill, and Newgate, ribald crowds of Londoners followed their progress, yelling abuse and hurling refuse and stones at the helpless captive. The saintly Henry heard his wife called a whore, and worse, before the Tower's gates mercifully closed behind him, muffling the hostile jeers. It was to be his home for the last decade of his sad life.
I mean, Edward, when I read that passage and also heard John reading it so beautifully there, I thought, on the one hand, you know, clearly what an awful moment for the king, but also what an operatic moment.
Maybe that's why I liked it so much. I mean, certainly, the story of Henry VI itself is fascinating because he was such a spiritual, artistic, and gentle man. I mean, strange, I'm sure. But that idea of him, you know, in public view, so close, in such close proximity to the braying public being taken back into London is extraordinary. And we can't identify with that at all nowadays. It's really an amazing image of both the jeopardy of the time and also an incredibly sort of close relationship between the public and the monarch.
Is it that sense of the kind of the turbulence, the flavour of politics lived almost on the streets during much of the time that this book covers that appeals, do you think? I mean, in some sense, it is rather different from a more democratic and, for the most part, perhaps, thankfully, more tranquil era that most of us have lived through.
Not sure. I'm not sure how to answer that. I mean, I love living in London. I wasn't born here, but I really feel it's my city. And I love living in a historical part of London. And anything that I'm not, I mean, I live in, I guess, about a mile away from the Tower of London itself. And anything that just makes my vision of the city or my vision of the history of the city more keen, I really love. I find it very, you know, I find it fascinating.
And obviously we're right in the middle of the Olympics at the moment and, you know, London is, you know, the focus of the world at least for a couple of weeks. Do you feel that along with this very strong sense of community which has been created, not least due to great sporting success, we could do with more of a sense of that historical trajectory that underpins the story that we've come to now?
It's hard, that, isn't it? And Olympics is about celebrating the present time and the future, one, you know, you hope. I mean, the opening ceremony, I suppose, had a flavour of some of the history of the country, but I'm not sure it's possible to do that. But hopefully, what you hope is that everything that's created by such an extraordinary sporting unifying event like the Olympics can be carried forward. I think it's much more forward-looking.
And I think that brings us to your final reading, because this is, you know, as you described, I think, earlier, a busman's holiday. It's a book on a subject that couldn't really be closer to home, and that is, of course, conducting. And this is the book Music as Alchemy by Tom Service. Now, it's a series of biographical sketches. It takes basically six conductors and their orchestras and says something about how they work on a particular concert at a particular time. And in a moment, we're going to hear a passage about Tom Service's experience of hearing one conductor, Ivan Fischer, conducting Mahler. But before we start, could you tell me why this particular passage jumped out at you when you were reading this book?
The passage, the chapter about Ivan Fischer and the Budapest Festival Orchestra, it starts off with this wonderful description of how they start rehearsals. And the conductor, and it's so utopian, and it could never, there are so few places in the world where it could exist. The orchestra tune up together under the direction of the conductor, and then they'll play Bach chorales together before they even, you know, get to the main meat of their programs, just to, you know, experiment and get a sense of sound and you know, the sense of ranges of sound and tuning. And it's kind of, yeah, it's wonderful and completely unique, I'd say.
From the opening bar, the music is energized by a collective will from the orchestra to make all the characters, colors, and contrasts that Fischer had developed in the week of rehearsals as vivid as possible. From the vice-like grip of the implacable repeated notes at the start of the first movement, the symphony creates an energy that is impossible to resist. It's a performance of gigantic structural momentum, a vindication of Mahler's self-conscious classical pretensions in this piece. More than any other of his symphonies, this piece takes the forms of the conventional 19th century symphony and stretches them to breaking point. But it's also a thrilling existential drama in which symphonic form is transmuted into psychological experience. The immediacy of the relationship between Fischer and his players releases something I have never heard in this music before. For those 90 minutes in the concert hall, there is no distance between us, the composer, the performers, and the piece. The Sixth Symphony is a journey we go on together, which Fischer and the players unflinchingly take to ecstatic, tragic extremes. By the end of the finale, the performance had created a trance that I find difficult to escape. The terrifying reality of the music makes the world of applause, of people, of social interaction after the concert seem a hollow illusion. It takes hours before the trance or the truth of Mahler's music recedes.
Thank you, John. Edward, Tom Service was clearly pretty much overwhelmed by the experience of hearing Fischer and the Budapest Band playing this Mahler Sixth. When you're on the podium, are you able to actually ever give yourself over to being absorbed by the performance in that way? Or when you're the man at the front of the orchestra, is there always a part of you that simply can't allow yourself to dive in quite that way?
I think you can be completely absorbed by a performance you're in, but it'll always be in a different way from an audience. And I mean, the performances where I felt most most integrated with somehow are the ones where you don't feel like you're working to create anything. It's just sort of happening with you and around you. Opera's very interesting like that because there are so many different facets, the singers, the children's choir, the offstage musicians, the pit, that you almost don't know when the great performances of a run are going to be. And I love it for that. I love that a performance is created and vanishes in the ether. But I don't think you ever have the same experience as someone in the audience. Another conductor said something very funny to me when this other conductor thinks he's done the most world-beating performances, he's told by people in the audience it's one of the worst, performances of something you've ever given. And then, conversely, when you feel like you've had a terrible evening in the pit or on the concert hall, because you felt slightly out of control, people tell you it had risen to great glories because of it. But so it's hard to say. Your experience is so different from that of an audience.
But when you are in the audience listening to someone else conducting something, do you find something of that kind of total absorption that Tom Service was talking about in the way?
Oh, sure. In great performances, for sure. Yeah, yeah. You're united with an audience in that. Yeah, I think an audience in a collective way feels that actually, which is it's a really wonderful thing to be in an auditorium as part of that mass of people experiencing something on that level.
In Music as Alchemy, Tom Service, he analyzes these conductors in a very rigorous way, but broadly speaking, he seems to divide them into two categories: conductors who really go minute by minute, page by page, over the score with the orchestra over and over again, and the guys, I'm not going to call them chancers, but people who live a little bit more on the edge, people who are really sort of saying, let's busk it and then see what happens on the day. Do you see yourself in either of those categories?
Well, I suppose that's how people divide conductors generally, isn't it? I mean, it's way too broad to say you're in one or other the category. I love the fact that he doesn't actually try and unify what these people are in the book, actually. I think he really presents a series of personalities working with a series of orchestral personalities, which I find is much more truthful. I wouldn't like to. It's up to other people to categorize me, I think, probably.
That's fair enough. And but within the book, there are particular conductors, and they're pretty much big name conductors, whose technique he analyzes. I mean, even Fischer is the extract that you chose there. Is Fischer someone that you know, that you've worked with?
I've trained a chorus for him in Salzburg many years ago. But he's someone I've admired, and I've admired that, as Tom would say, that alchemy, or that, you know, that connection between a great orchestra and a great conductor is something which really fascinates me. And that connection between any orchestra and any conductor is really fascinating. And he has something very special with that orchestra.
If you had one fantasy conductor, as it were, that you could spend time with and look into his technique, who would that be?
I think most conductors give you the same answer, which is Carlos Kleiber. I was fortunate enough that one of my great friends didn't send me a clip of him conducting Rosenkavalier on a Pitt camera until after I'd finished conducting Rosenkavalier, because it's effortless and brilliant and varied. And I think you'd want another career after watching too much of his stuff, because it's peerless and so expressive, but so the intention of it is so clear.
Well, with those thoughts, we are, I'm afraid, drawing to a close for this event, but it's been a great pleasure to have you here. So many thanks to Edward Gardner, and many thanks also to our reader, John Rowe. Thank you both very much indeed.
Rana Mitter presented this evening's Proms Plus Literary event, and the producer was Zahid Worley. Well, this is Penny Gore welcoming you back to the Royal Albert Hall and this BBC Prom, given by the BBC Symphony Orchestra under Semyon Bychkov. We're live on BBC Radio 3 and online, where you can listen in high-definition sound. And you can follow us on Twitter too, at BBC Proms is the place to be. Now, it was announced just yesterday that Semyon Bychkov has had a new post with the BBC Symphony Orchestra created for him, the Günter Wandt Conducting Chair, a mark of the warm relationship he's forged with the players. And next, he conducts them in a real orchestral titan by a composer with whom he has a great affinity. It's Richard Strauss's tone poem Ein Heldenleben, commonly translated as A Hero's Life. Although tonight's conductor, Semyon Bychkov, makes a subtle distinction.
Ein Heldenleben, to be translated correctly, would not mean hero's life. It would mean heroic life. And that is quite interesting, because it stops being about an individual, whether it is Strauss or it is anyone else, a specific hero. Once you think that it is about heroic life, well, every life is heroic. Every life that is worthwhile is going to be heroic, because there are sacrifices that are going to be made, losses that will be incurred, certain goals that will need to be attained, and they can only be done through utmost dedication. So the piece become a lot more meaningful, and not a description of war or love. It is actually a life cycle. And that a man, as young as he was when he composed it in his early 30s, was capable of expressing something so true to life that he was also able to anticipate in the final coda what he and every one of us will feel throughout different stages of one's life, including the final stage. That is really as great a genius as one can be.
Semyon Bychkov. Well, at almost 50 minutes long, this work is as heroic in scale as it is in subject matter, and written for large orchestral forces. Strauss wrote the piece in the late 1890s, when he was at the peak of his early professional career. He'd become a well-known conductor, especially distinguished for his interpretations of Wagner, while his own composing career was progressing nicely too, thanks to a string of impressive tone poems. Within a few years, he'd embark on his long run of highly successful operas. But all this apparent good fortune wasn't quite as seamless as it might sound. Strauss's first opera, the Wagner-inspired Guntram, hadn't been a great hit. In fact, the critics had given it a real pasting. And Strauss had a long memory when it came to professional slights. The whole painful experience of the opera was just one of the ingredients that he blended to produce Ein Heldenleben. although he did keep his sense of humour, the protagonist, let's say with at least elements of Strauss himself, is just too noble and upstanding to be true, bravely battling with those critics whose mean-spirited carping emerges as a gruff chorus of woodwind, two tubas and trombones. But our hero wins the day in his battle with the bad guys. Cue a mischievous quote from the horn theme from Don Juan. Finally, he withdraws from the hustle and bustle of the world with his faithful companion by his side. And that's a thinly disguised portrait of Strauss's own wife, the soprano Paulina de Anna, who was famed for her volatile personality. Strauss once described her as very complex, very feminine, a little perverse, at every minute different from how she had been the moment before. And all her lightning changes of mood are captured by a coquettish solo violin. And the BBC Symphony Orchestra just settled down, awaiting the arrival of Semyon Bychkov, who makes his way on stage now to conduct this BBC Proms performance of Ein Heldenleben by Richard Strauss.